You know, the online world is great for so many things. It's great for making you laugh, it's great for entertainment, and every now and again you come across ideas or people that literally blow your mind. But I still think some of my best thinking happens offline. So join me, Nessa, on Offline Thoughts as I chat about some of the things I think about when I'm not online. I'm really glad you're listening, and I hope you enjoy the episode. So in last week's episode, I went through the UK Supreme Court ruling that we had received in mid-April, where the judges that were, you know, conducting the judicial review came to a unanimous agreement that the meaning of the words woman, man, and sex in the Equalities Act of 2010, which is the legislation that protects a number of groups' rights in the UK, that when Parliament had enacted that Equalities Act of 2010, what they had meant was biological sex as opposed to certificated sex. I had also gone through just what was some of the arguments that had been brought forward by both sides and how I felt both sides performed. And then I had said that I would come back this week and I would specifically focus on the arguments that the trans movement makes in advancing or advocating for the rights of trans people. And all of these, by the way, aren't necessarily things that were said in the specific court case, but they are things that come up often, like over and over again, in the general discourse around the trans debate and the trans movement's advocacy for its rights. So without further ado, let me go into the first one. The first one comes about when, in response to, for example, the latest ruling where the UK Supreme Court has said that the interpretations of the word sex, woman and man, is on the basis of biological sex or biological reality, a lot of the responses from pro-trans sort of publications, and also just general activists that you can watch videos on off online, is the idea that by rooting these definitions in biological sex, it's essentially erasing the presence and existence of trans people. And I think here what they're saying essentially is that language is very important. And so if we accept the idea that there's a categorization of people based on gender, and there are only two genders recognized in law, i.e. man and woman, it essentially means that you are erasing them, at least from the language of the legislation, because there is no like additional categories for transgender people where it's, for example, you have definitions for man, definition for woman, and definition for trans man and trans woman. So they're saying because these terms, the trans terms, aren't specifically included in legislation, then it is, by at least on a linguistic level or on a language level, erasing them from the legislation. And what they're saying is that it's by extension also trying to erase their existence and their ability to sort of be visible and to be able to participate in real life. So in a very social sense, they're being exiled, if you will, or they're being erased. Now, what I will say to this is, like I said in last week's episode, we are where we are today. And the nature of society and the nature of language is that, like, naturally things evolve. Like, we all the time recategorize things. We start calling things in a different way, which we alter the language that we speak or the way in which we communicate with other people based on social dynamics or social progress or cultural shifts. So for example, in terms of labeling, there's a time when Black people were called all kinds of different things that are now considered to be pejorative or considered to be offensive or considered to be racist. And as time has gone by, we've landed on people being Black people or people of African descent being categorized in this specific way, but that wasn't always the case. And so in terms of the evolution of language where trans interests are concerned, I definitely accept that the legislation in general also has to adapt and move forward, because there is a greater presence of trans people in public life and in social life. And so there has to be a categorization, especially when those things are relevant, because of course your identity or your gender identity or your sex isn't always relevant, but where it is, they do need to specifically be referred to when it's important. Now, the part where I don't agree is that classification according to reality is in itself erasure. So You can categorize people on any number of factors, but when we're talking specifically about sex, like sex clearly is a binary. You either are a man or you are a woman. I mean, you start off as being a girl child and a boy child, and you grow up to be a man or a woman. And that is biological. It's obviously immutable or non-changeable. And the reason why we know that it's non-changeable is that even when people transition, they have to have a lifetime of medical intervention for them to continue to present in a way that is opposite to their biological sex or their biological reality. So we know that sex is a real thing that can't be changed, regardless of what somebody does. Although, of course, there's cosmetic procedures and medical procedures that can help people look the way they would like to feel, or people look closer to the way that they feel on the inside. However, the categorization still holds. So what they ideally would like is, and by they I mean the trans movement, they would like the categorizations to work like this. You have a categorization for women and you have a categorization for men. And within the categorization of women, there's different sub-definitions or subgroups within women. So there's like short women, there's tall women, there's big women, there's slim women, there's Asian women, there's black women, there's white women, and there's also trans women. So they just want it to be a categorization of women, and then they are under that umbrella as just a different type of woman. In the same way that there's women of all sizes and shapes and backgrounds, they want it to sort of be like, and trans women is a different version of that. And then similarly on the man side, there's like tall men, short men, big men, slim men, men of all varieties, and trans men would ideally like to be categorized under the general umbrella of man. Like, there's also a different type of man called a trans man. And so going back to the UK Supreme Court ruling a few weeks ago, and specifically what they said about the definition of man and woman and sex on biological terms, what the trans movement is saying is that by removing the possibility of trans people being legally recognized under their preferred or certificated sex. So if they are born a man, but they identify as a woman, but are not legally recognized as a woman, it's essentially erasing them from the overarching umbrella definition of womanhood. And then similarly for trans men, if they are not recognized under the umbrella of man, then they are essentially being removed from existence. They're being erased out, because under that definition, that same definition, it'll include other subgroups of men. So it'll include like men of different minority ethnic groups, different religious groups, different physical characterization. And so they're saying like all those groups are still included, but you've removed trans men from being another subcategory of the overarching umbrella definition of man. So when they're talking about sort of like trans people still exist and you're trying to remove them from existence or trying to erase them from life, essentially, I think largely speaking, that's what they're saying. Now, the response to that is simply that the problem lies at the root of having a problem with the classification, because they see the classification as being inherently negative when it's actually a neutral term. So man, for example, isn't a slur, and woman isn't a slur. And even when you call people who are like men, women, that isn't a slur necessarily, because for a slur to be the case, you have to believe that the inherent word is offensive, but it isn't offensive, it's just being misapplied. And the way I think about this is in terms of like the N-word, for example. The reason why the N-word is offensive when you say it to people is because the word is inherently racist. It's a term that was made up to levy against people of African descent, people who are black, in a like derogatory and disrespectful way. So it's obviously understandable that if you were to say that to somebody, they're going to have a negative response because the word is inherently negative. But other words like tall and short, words like man and woman, they themselves aren't actually offensive. And if you categorize people according to the reality of who they are, then that in itself is just simple classification. It isn't actually an insult. Whereas I understand there's other terms for, of course, for trans people, there are insults that are akin or similar in nature to the N-word, where the words were inherently designed to be offensive to those groups, but that doesn't apply to the simple terms man and woman. And then taking that further and connecting that to the point about, like, existence, labeling somebody what they are isn't the same thing as erasing them from reality. One, because it's impossible to erase people from reality, like, they are still in front of us, they're still there. And even when you call somebody something that they are not, they still remain that thing, they still remain there, they still exist. And so, for example, if I was to call my sister by a different name, it wouldn't mean that she doesn't exist. It would just be a misclassification. It would be me identifying her incorrectly, but that would have no impact on whether or not she existed or not. And so with sort of like the argument that classifying men and women as men and women is erasing the existence of trans people isn't correct, because these labels or classifications are only relevant in places where they are relevant. So, for example, when you go back to the Equalities Act and you're trying to define what protections specific groups have, it's very important to have an accurate classification, because the classification is the basis on which they accrue their rights. So, for example, we have protections in favor of people who are sick, because we don't want a situation where employers can discriminate against them on the basis of their illness. So things like firing them or not promoting them or penalizing them for their illnesses is unlawful. And so for us to determine whether an employer acted unlawfully in their treatment of somebody who's sick, we have to decide what sickness means. We have to decide what illness is. We have to classify that group of people according to certain definitions that make sense for the group. And so if you were to include, like, non-sick people in that group, that obviously would fundamentally alter the group structure and how we are able to classify that group. It would also kind of render the definition of being a person who suffers with a chronic condition or who is sick, it would render that definition pointless, because the individual members of that group don't all share the same characteristics. So what you've done is you've created a label for people who are sick, and then you've included people who are not sick. So the classification no longer works. But in either situation, in no matter how you classify both those groups, like the groups of sick and non-sick, it does not have any impact as to whether either group exists or does not exist based on that classification. So just because, for example, you've decided that a group of people are classified as sick and they have to be given certain protections, it doesn't mean that the people who are not sick cease to exist. And so going back to the sort of rhetoric of, you know, trans activists when they're speaking about this Supreme Court ruling resulting in the erasure of trans people, I just don't think that's an accurate way of speaking about the discussion, because what we're talking about here is the classification for very specific contexts, and where sex obviously is of paramount importance. So it isn't the same thing as erasing something by just classifying that somebody or people accurately, especially when the words themselves have no negative or positive connotation. They're just neutral statements about the reality of people for the purposes of assuring each group's legal protections. Now, the second point that I wanted to talk about was the idea that anybody can be trans, or put in a different way, that the barrier to entry for being considered a trans person has been lowered to such an extent that literally anybody can be trans now. I think that's a very destructive component for the trans movement, because when you aren't able to gatekeep, when you aren't able to control, like, what classifies as trans, when you're not able to limit who can identify as that particular group, it means that you're vulnerable to people who are, like, grifters, you're vulnerable to interlopers, you're vulnerable to fraudsters, and you're vulnerable to people with malicious aims. And you can clearly see that this has been something that the trans movement has suffered from, because, like, genuine trans people who have gender dysphoria, who have been living as their preferred sex for a very long time, who are quietly getting on with life, are essentially being like weaponized by people who aren't like genuinely trans people. So there used to be, and I would say this is probably like before 2014, before sort of Stonewall changed their position on what their primary focus was, which was the interests of gay people, to what the interests of trans people was. Before then, like, there was very clear boundaries between like gender nonconformity, where it's the person's identity. So by that I mean, there was a definition for transsexual, which meant that it was a person who had changed their sex through like medical intervention, namely through operation or having a sex change as it's known. And through this operation and through this medical intervention, they became a transsexual person. So think of, for example, for men who have their penis removed and it's replaced by a vaginoplasty, they would be known as transsexual people. There's a distinction between transsexual people and transgender people. So transgender people are people who like identify as the opposite sex, but they haven't necessarily done anything beyond that. Like, they haven't had any medical intervention, they might not have had any like hormones, they certainly haven't had like the sex change operation. And so for them, the transness is in the fact that they want to live as much as possible as the opposite gender, but they aren't transsexual because they haven't changed their like secondary sexual characteristics. So they haven't, if they're a man, they haven't had their penis removed, and if they're a woman, they haven't had like a mastectomy. And then there's a distinction between those two groups, so the groups of transsexual and transgender, and general cross-dressers or transvestites. And back in the day, it honestly wasn't offensive, and to a segment of the population still isn't offensive to be referred to as a cross-dresser or a transvestite, because that is or was a very distinct category. It didn't fall under the transsexual label or to fall under the transgender label. And cross-dressers and transvestites, we still have them, and I don't think that they consider the term offensive. So when you think about drag queens or drag kings, they're essentially people who dress in the opposite sex to who they are. So drag kings are women who are dressed up as men, but they don't see themselves as men. They just enjoy for performances to wear men's clothes. Similar with drag queens, like drag queens in their everyday life, when they're not performing on stage or performing wherever they're performing, they don't see themselves as women. They don't consider themselves transgender people or transsexual people, because they're not. They consider themselves basically performance artists who perform in the opposite gender clothes. So they literally are transvestites. Vestites just means clothes, and trans means you're doing the opposite, essentially. Like, you're performing the opposite of what you are. So they're drag queens are men who are wearing clothes of the opposite sex. That's all it is. And drag kings are wearing clothes for the opposite sex. So they're women wearing men's clothes. And usually it's in a performance setting, but it's not necessarily always. So from these very defined definitions of transsexual, transgender, and then how they were just completely delineated from cross-dressers and transvestites in general, that distinction over time has kind of melted away. So over time, to be a person who is trans or who is transgendered basically just means anybody who doesn't perform the stereotypical like expression of gender. So for example, for women who aren't like girly, who are tomboys, they now can consider themselves trans as well. Or for men who are not traditionally like macho, or like, you know, into like really manly boyish stuff, they are gender non-conforming, and they can be considered under the trans umbrella if they identify as non-binary. And non-binary is one of those terms that doesn't really mean anything, because it means so much at the same time. So some people use non-binary to mean I don't identify as a man and I don't identify as a woman. It can also mean that I identify as both. So I identify as a man and a woman. It can mean that I identify as a man and a woman at different times. So sometimes I feel more masculine, sometimes I feel more feminine, but at neither point do I feel like just one. And it can be like on a daily basis, it could be on like a weekly basis, it could be on a yearly basis. So how their identities manifest can fluctuate essentially, like very quickly or very little depending on the person. Now the net effect of all of that, the net effect of watering down what it means to be transsexual, watering down what it means to be a trans person in general, especially when you start including like non-binary identities. And by the way, I just listed like a few ways to be non-binary, but there's like 10 or 20 other ways to be non-binary. So by watering down what it means to be trans and transsexual, it means that it's very difficult to effectively lobby for the interests of that group in a coherent way, because so many different like subgroups within that are jostling or asking for different things. And sometimes, especially when it's the group who are sort of trender, like gender trenders, like they're kind of young people who are experimenting with their identities, and you know damn well that in like 5 years time when they've graduated, they're just going to like go back to gender conforming. But at the time, they're one of the most vocal groups. It means they start asking for things that are kind of unreasonable. So it's one thing asking for the population writ large to refer to you in your preferred like pronouns, and I think that's fine. We do that with other things as well, but because they've allowed like young people who are experimental with their identities, who are kind of like jumping on the bandwagon and aren't genuinely trans people, they'll start asking for things like alternative pronouns. So if you've seen that chart of like hundreds of ways to be addressed, it's not just she, her, they, them. It's like these Z's and Z's and all kinds of different pronouns. It's like they'll kind of start demanding that people learn like these alternative ways of like pronouning people that just people are not familiar with. And honestly, it's so complicated. Also within that group, you're including other people who are not necessarily like good faith actors. So you'll have men, for example, who are in prisons for violent crimes, who know damn well that if they identify out of their sex, they can have an easier time in prison. So instead of being in like male prisons that predominantly house like violent criminals, like most men are in prison for violent crimes, for sexual crimes, whereas like 95% of women in prison are not in prison for any sexual crimes or violent crimes. And so because the men's prisons house such dangerous people, of course like men are gonna have a harder time. It's just a more dangerous place to be in general. So when you've lowered the barrier to entry so low, where the trans can mean anything at any time and anybody can acquire that identity, you have bad faith actors like men serving hard time for sexual crimes, violent crimes, identifying out of their identity because all they have to do is essentially just say they are. They don't have to have the operation. They don't have to like get any medical treatment. They don't have to have lived that way for a long time. They don't have to prove it to anybody. They just have to say that they feel that way. And then they're able to basically like enjoy the benefits or rights that trans people have fought for. And whilst like, you know, that can be good on a temporary basis. So for example, I'm sure it's very validating for trans people when things like prison systems say that they're going to admit people on the basis of their gender identity. It's affirming that their identities like are real, that people respect their identities, that people are welcoming of their identities, that they're being included in all these important ways. That feels good, but it's short-lived in the sense that these bad faith actors who've like clung onto or attached themselves to the trans movement without actually truly being trans are going to bring sooner or later the movement into disrepute, as we saw. So for example, in the case I just talked about with the prison, with the prisons in Scotland, choosing to say that they're going to admit trans women into female prisons, literally no time had passed before the men who had been admitted to those prisons, raped and sexually assaulted some of the female inmates. And so what happens in those high profile cases is that because these trans grifters have made themselves so visible and they've attached themselves to the trans movement, when there is backlash, the backlash isn't just to that specific interloper or that specific like criminal who was identifying as a trans person to like escape having to serve the hard time that he should have served in male prisons. When the backlash takes place, it's against the trans movement as a whole. But the root of the issue is that the barrier to entry has been lowered so low, or there is no gatekeeping as to who is a trans person or who should be considered a trans person, because there are literally no requirements for being trans. As I said, there's no requirements whatsoever. It doesn't require you to like be passing, it doesn't require you to have any operations, it doesn't require you to have changed a long time ago, it doesn't require you to maintain it every day of the week, it doesn't require anything. And so these bad faith actors, whether it's in the prison system or whether it's like men who are clearly cheaters in sports who've been like mediocre performers when they were participating in male sports and then they decide they want to win by joining the female sports, when the backlash eventually comes, as it always does, the net effect is detrimental to the trans movement, because they're going to be associated naturally with those bad faith actors. So I think in general, in movements in general, whether it's this particular one that I'm talking about or even when it comes to like other movements, it's very important to gatekeep. And actually, this just made me think that I might do an episode on Black Lives Matter and some of the interlopers in that organization that kind of brought them to disrepute. But for now, gatekeeping is very important. And speaking of gatekeeping and trans issues, or not even trans issues, but the general larger LGBT like label, I think it's incredibly problematic to start including people like asexual people or aromantic people, because that isn't a sexual orientation. It's a preference as to like how. So for example, asexual, a person's considered asexual if they have sex fewer than, I think it's fewer than 12 times a year. I think that's what the number is. So it's a statement about people's sexual appetites. Same with aromantic. It's the idea that people like don't feel romantic feelings to people naturally, or there's certain like rigid conditions that must take place before they experience like romantic connection. But again, that speaks to love language almost to me, like the things that people need to do to unlock your feelings of romance. But either way, it has nothing to do with like same-sex attraction or the legal protections that people need so that they aren't discriminated against on the basis of their sexual orientation. I just can't think of a single scenario in which somebody has lost their jobs or has been fired or has been persecuted because they're asexual or aromantic. And then other labels have been attached to the LGB movement is intersex. Like, I'm not entirely sure why intersex has been added on, because again, intersex is a medical disorder. It's a disorder in which people's chromosomes don't necessarily match their secondary characteristics. So either way, it's like the person will either be male or female, but then the outside of their bodies will match what their chromosomes are. So again, it's a medical disorder. So I'm not really sure why that's been tagged on. And then I obviously also feel that way about non-binary people. Like when you include absolutely everything under a definition, it renders a definition weakened to the point of being like unuseful in advancing the interests of that particular group. And I very much feel like part of the massive backlash that the trans movement is experiencing is because there's been so many people included under the umbrella of transness, because there is no longer a workable, coherent, like consistent definition that requires things of people before they can have that label. It just means that literally anybody, whether they're good faith actors or bad faith actors, can fall under that umbrella. The third argument that I don't think is very persuasive in when it's used in the trans debate by trans activists is not something that is explicitly said, but it's always implicitly in the argumentation that are made. And this is this idea that essentially women's interests and women's like rights should be subordinated to the interests and rights of trans women. But that's not how individual groups' rights are supposed to work. Like, when you have a situation where you have multiple marginalized groups, you can't have a hierarchy in which one group is over the other, especially when they're both like requiring of separate but equal protections. And so the way this manifests is in the discourse around single-sex spaces. And when we're talking about single-sex spaces and the only options available is to include like men who identify as women into female spaces, it's kind of implying that women as a group should relinquish their rights to single-sex spaces because trans women would like to be included in those spaces. But it should equally be as valid an argument that we just make it normal that there are third spaces. Third spaces are either specifically for trans people, although I don't think they'd like that, because it would mark them out as being trans, and so people might target them if targeting is happening. But they could have, the third spaces would have to be like mixed sex spaces, essentially. So you'd have male spaces, female spaces, and then spaces that are open to both. And actually, one of the things that was released a week or so after, maybe even like a few days after the UK Supreme Court, was the guidance from the Equality and Human Rights Commission, who advised that third spaces would basically have to be single, like single self-contained units, like unit bathrooms, with where there is no like cubicle. You know how you can go into those bathrooms and you can see people's feet? It can't be that. It has to be closed all the way to the ceiling, closed all the way to the bottom. That way you guarantee the complete privacy of the person and also the complete safety of the person. So I think those third spaces, especially when they are configured in that way, are completely reasonable, because the only solution cannot be a solution that subordinates women's interests to the interests of men who identify as women, essentially, because there's a very specific reason, as I'll talk about, why single-sex spaces are for the protection of women. Now, the fourth argument that's made is around the idea that sex is obsolete, that sex as a concept is outdated, that it's obsolete, that in the future, and what the future is a sexless society, a society in which people are not organized on the basis of their sex or categorized on their basis of their sex, but categorized on the basis of their gender identity or their preference for how they would like to be perceived by the other members of society. Now, in previous points, I've already talked about a little bit of the crime statistics. I mentioned the nature of violent and sexual crimes being male crimes, and when you look at the stats, it really shouts at you that that's just the world that we live in. So you can find this stat online, and it's that 98% of all sexual violence is committed by men. And when I say the 98%, I'm capturing both the violence that males commit against women and also the violence that they commit against other men. So all violent crimes, regardless of who the victim is, whether that victim is a man or a woman, is committed by men. Similarly, like the overwhelming majority of like homicides, it's over the 90% level, is committed by men. And you also consider the fact that the majority of the people who are trafficked around the world to be sexually exploited, the fact that they are women as well, or that the majority of global wealth, so that is like land, inherited wealth, financial assets, that all those things are overwhelmingly or over 50%, but I think it's actually in like the 60 or 70 percentile level. All of that is controlled by men. And then also in other things that you wouldn't consider, like most medical research and health and safety research is conducted by men and with men in mind, or with men at the center of the analysis. And what that means is that most medical research that we know and most health and safety like sort of information or facts that we have aren't actually like applicable or necessarily applicable to women. They're applicable to men. They're based on the information that we've acquired from researching men and men's bodies and how they respond to things and how their bodies respond to stimuli in the environment and how they become ill and how they are treated for those illnesses. An example that really captures this is that when we think about what the symptoms of a heart attack are, you know, even just from like media or like TV or like films that we've seen, we all know that when somebody's having a heart attack, they like clutch their chest. It looks like they're in pain because they've got like a spasm in their chest. They often collapse over and their face just looks very, very like strained, like they're in this great pain. And or sometimes we know that their left arm goes dead and then they clasp their chest with their right hand. Either way, the symptoms are mostly like left arm going dead, chest pain, chest tightness, and like not breathing well. Well, the thing is that it's actually very important to know that information, because when you can recognize those symptoms in somebody, you can potentially be somebody who saves their lives because you can act very quickly. But the thing about those symptoms is that they're the symptoms for men. Like, that's not how women have heart attacks. And I can guarantee you the average person does not know what the symptoms for a heart attack in a woman will be, or in heart attack in women will be, which means that they can't recognize the symptoms very quickly and they aren't able to act very quickly because they don't have that general knowledge, which means that probably women are more likely to suffer more severe consequences or even potentially die at a higher rate because we aren't socialized to know or study how illnesses manifest in women. There's actually this great book called Invisible Women that talks a great deal about that, that my partner's currently reading, and she's sort of just been telling me like tidbits, and it's honestly truly shocking. And so if you are interested, like, the symptoms of a heart attack in a woman is not the left arm going dead and chest pain. It's actually pain in the upper back or abdomen, along with like somebody who's like rapidly breathing or who seems to have like shortness of breath. They might also have nausea, they might also have vomiting, and they also like can appear like to be extremely fatigued. Like, all of a sudden they go from being like normal to just being extremely tired or extremely fatigued. So those symptoms are just like radically different to the symptoms that we know to be for men when they're having a heart attack. Now, my point about all of this is that we are never going to escape a life in which things are organized on the basis of sex, because it's so deeply entrenched into every areas of our lives, even areas that you wouldn't have thought about, like I just described in medical research, for example. And because our world is so deeply gendered, or it's organized in like all these powerful ways around sex, and also because men and women clearly behave very, very differently, if 90% of all sexual violent crimes are committed by men, that pattern is undeniable and obviously is rooted in biological sex and biological reality. And so this utopia, this future utopia, this future of progress in which sex doesn't matter, is never going to materialize, like I said, because sex rules so much of our life, in particular so much of women's lives. And being able to classify those crimes, for example, as male crimes actually is very important, because you're able to address them effectively, because you can recognize the pattern of how each group offends and put policies designed to either deter them or to punish them in a way that results in less of those violent crimes or crimes taking place. So classification is very important, but also because we live in a gendered society, in a society in which sex has a material impact, particularly on the lives of women in a very negative way, and that necessitates legal protection for them in all these various ways, you know, like, sex is always going to be important. Biological sex is always going to be important. And denying that only hurts women. It only hurts women because we aren't able to implement the policies that assures or at least goes some way into guaranteeing their safety and protection. Now, the fifth argument is again another implicit argument, and that is the idea that sex only matters to trans women and men. And by that I mean, clearly sex must matter to them because they feel gender dysphoria, i.e. they feel as though their feelings on the inside, or how their self-identity or their self-perception doesn't match how they physically appear in the world, so it doesn't match their biological reality. And so it's so important to them, the sex part defines how they feel about their bodies and how they feel about themselves in such a fundamental way that they go to all these means to be able to be perceived by people, by society, as their preferred sex. So the reason why people would have medical intervention is because sex is at the root of their gender dysphoria, and they would like to alter their sex in a way that allows them to be perceived as the opposite sex, so they feel more comfortable in their bodies, and that society or people can interact with them in a way that feels more reflective of how they feel on the inside. That's an example of sex being super, super important. But it's also equally true that sex is very important to non-trans people, or to people who are like men and women who aren't trans identifying, because their sex, especially when it concerns women, is also, as I just spoke about in my previous point, very like paramount to how the world interacts with them and how in particular men interact with them. So in terms of like guaranteeing their safety and protection under the law from the things that men do to them, clearly their sex impacts their lives in a very important way. But also even outside like legal issues or protection issues or safety issues or trying to shield women from the violence of men, in terms of sort of like identities as well, women as well value their identities as women. So for example, people who have children, mothers who have children, often are very proud and often speak about how that's a defining experience for them. Motherhood and femaleness takes on a whole new light, or they interpret themselves in a whole new way once they go through these fundamentally feminine experiences. Or women are analyzing how they interact with the world and how the world interacts with them. Sex and their sex identity, like their biological identities, again, are super, super important to them because it's the lens through which the world responds and interacts with them, but it's the lens through which they understand their own existence as well. So again, it isn't true that sex is very important to like trans people, but is completely immaterial to people who aren't trans. It's equally important to both groups, and therefore, in order to find a path forward that is equitable to both groups, it has to like remember that. It has to remember that if sex is important to both groups, then the solution that's arrived at should factor that into the solution, or bake that into the solution. An example, like a practical example where you can see this idea that in pursuit of creating a more inclusive place for trans people, we've ignored the fact that sex is also important to women in particular, is in the language around like female bodies. So on the one hand, you want to create language that also factors in that trans men also require like feminine care. So consider like the fact that trans men will also still need cervical smears. They'll also need mammograms if they should experience like breast cancer. There's also other things, other cancers they can experience with their ovaries, for example, or just other illnesses that are based on their biological sex. So you don't want to like write language in the medical sphere that alienates them or excludes them, or where they find it difficult to know that they're also being spoken about, especially in the context of how there's a lot of misinformation about what it means to be trans. So I was speaking to my sister a couple of weeks ago, and I was surprised to learn that she didn't know that like trans women most of the time don't have gender reassignment surgery. It's literally less than 5% of the population who are trans women have had like their penis removed. And so that has an impact in terms of how they're going to interact with women in female spaces, especially like vulnerable female spaces like rape crisis centers, for example. If you have like people with penises, men with penises in those spaces, like that's gonna disturb the environment for women. Or for example, how a lot of young people think that you can actually become the opposite sex. So like it'll be like really young lesbians, and not like super, super young, like let's say late teens, early 20s, where they believe that if one of them transitions to being a trans man, that they can father the child of the other one. But the fact is, obviously they can't because they remain a woman, they remain female. Like the way they present externally is going to change, but obviously everything else doesn't. Like they're still women, they don't have sperm, they won't have XY chromosomes, they won't be able to father a child, they'll still be affected by female illnesses. Like, they don't know that you can't change sex. But in terms of like sex being important to everybody, the reason why there was backlash around the language used by the NHS, the National Health Service in the UK, when it started publishing information that was supposed to be read by women and using terms like chest feeders instead of saying breast, or using terms like bonus hole instead of saying vagina, or using words like penis havers instead of saying men, all those things like resulted in like massive backlash from women in particular, because it was seen as erasing like women's sex and how important like their sex is to them. The fact that it's important that they have breasts, it's important they have a vagina, it's important that they're able to breastfeed, it's important that they're not recognized as like as non-women people, you know. So again, like, sex is important to everybody, it just manifests differently. And in the rhetoric that the trans movement is using, where the push for inclusion is coming along with the erasure of the language that's important in recognizing the biological sex of women, it's going to continue to experience a backlash, because not only do those words not sound good, it also pivots on the idea that women's sex, or the sex of women, isn't important to women, that we can just get rid of those terms without any effect on how women feel about themselves and how women feel, because sex and things that are based on biological sex aren't important to women. Well, clearly they are. Now, the sixth argument, and one that I'm incredibly passionate about, is the argument that's made that there can be such a thing as a male lesbian, or that trans women or men who identify as women, when they are attracted to women, can be considered lesbians. Now, we've had a lot of high-profile cases in which lesbian-only events have been labeled as being discriminatory towards trans women, and also been essentially shut down and being prevented from operating, because the idea is that by excluding trans women from like lesbian events, it is essentially saying that trans women aren't women. Now, I'm not particularly aware of a similar or parallel situation with trans men sort of wanting to be included in gay men events, but I would imagine that if they did, it wouldn't go down well either. But the reason why this particular argumentation I've been super passionate about is because I find it incredibly homophobic, because it is essentially delegitimizing the idea that you are attracted to women as a woman on the basis of their sex, but every other group is able to be exclusionary or discriminatory in their sexual like orientation. That's kind of the definition of orientation. It is by nature discriminatory against all other sexual orientations. So if you're a straight person, what you're saying is you only date people of the opposite sex, and you discriminate or you exclude all other people. So if you aren't of the opposite sex, that person will not be attracted to you because their attraction or their orientation is on the basis of sex. Similarly with gay men, the reason they necessarily, for the definition to make sense, have to exclude everybody who isn't a man, because they are men who are sexually orientated towards being attracted to other men. And so it necessarily is exclusionary, because the definition only holds by excluding the other groups. So if you're a gay man who sleeps with women, then you obviously aren't a gay man, you're a bisexual man or a straight man, but you're not a gay man. Same with a straight man that sleeps with men. You're not a straight man, you're either a gay man or you're a bisexual man, because being a straight man means a very specific thing. And that specific thing is that you are opposite sex attracted. Same with if you are a straight woman. If you're a straight woman who sleeps with women, then you're a gay woman. Or you're a bisexual woman, potentially, if you also sleep with men. But you certainly aren't like a lesbian, because lesbian is women who are exclusively sexually orientated towards other women. And so when trans activists are talking about the cotton ceiling, which is this idea that women, specifically lesbian women, will include trans women in social situations or social events or in just like in society, in public life, but that when it comes to the private sphere, when it comes to romantic and sexual relationships, they don't include trans women. And the term is designed to mirror the term, obviously, glass ceiling, which is this idea that there is a cap on the achievements that women can attain. So they might have been like now able to go into workplaces and work, and they might even progress through the ranks, but that there's a ceiling of achievement that they are capped at. So they're not on the boards of big organizations, for example. They're not the CEOs of these companies. Like, they can be managers and senior managers, but there's a cap to their achievements, if you will. So that's what the cotton ceiling is supposed to mirror. It's the idea that there's a cap to the inclusion of trans women in female spaces, and in this particular case, in the sexual sphere, as far as lesbians are concerned. Clearly, this is an incredibly homophobic take on what it means to be a same-sex attracted person, because every other group is able to have a definition that includes attraction on the basis of sex, not gender presentation, not certificated sex, not like how they identify or the words that they use to refer to themselves and their bodies, but biological sex. So straight men are allowed to have their straightness defined according to sexual reality, the fact that they're attracted to women. Similarly with bisexual men, they're attracted to men and women. Similarly to straight women, they're attracted to men. So equally, women are also attracted to women on the basis of sex. And I think, to be honest, like, the reason why this kind of argument can even be said with a straight face is because lesbophobia, or like the homophobia that women experience, that lesbians experience, is very different to the homophobia that gay men experience. The gay men experience homophobia on the basis that people consider their same-sex attraction like perverted almost, or like unnatural. Whereas women, lesbians experience homophobia on the basis that they don't even consider their like the sex that they have as real sex, as legitimate sex. And so it's almost like, oh, you know, they don't even matter because what they're doing isn't real sex. So that's the kind of homophobia that lesbians experience. And when you deny the fact that women who are same-sex attracted, i.e. lesbians, are attracted on the basis of their sex, it's kind of like what you're saying. It's kind of like you're saying like, oh, like your sexual orientation and sexual attraction doesn't really matter. For you as a group, like, it's not about sex. It's about like something else that we can't define, but the sex isn't actually important. But it's like, no, like lesbians are attracted to lesbians on the basis of sex. They're attracted to female bodies. They're attracted to breasts. They're attracted to vaginas. They're attracted, I don't want to get too vulgar here, but they are sexually aroused by the sex part of women. It isn't just that women smell nice, or they've got softer skin, or they tend to be more socially adaptable and socially gentle, and they're not violent. It isn't just those things. Like, the primary thing is the fact that they're physically women. And so the argument around like sort of there being a cotton ceiling, or the fact that there can be male lesbians, all that stuff is inherently homophobic. And also I would posit it's also like rapey. It's like men have always been trying to violate the boundaries that women set, and they'll use different mechanisms to do so. One of those mechanisms, for example, is just not taking no for an answer. So in this situation where lesbians have said like, yeah, no, we're attracted to each other on the basis of sexual orientation, and that doesn't mean that we're not kind and polite and inclusive to trans women where sex isn't relevant, or like bodies aren't relevant, but in the romantic and sexual sphere, that's a highly relevant area. And so of course we're going to exclude men, we're going to exclude people with penises because we are lesbians, we're same-sex attracted people. And in the UK Supreme Court ruling, like, one of the things that was like really hard to miss was, one, the fact that it was led by women, and also that there was a coalition of women across all political spheres. It wasn't just that it was like right fascists that were leading this. It was like people on the left, it was people in the center, it was people on the right, and also most importantly, it was both led by straight women and gay women. And actually lesbians were quite at the forefront of this, because one of the interveners was the Lesbian Project, that's headed by Kathleen Stock and Julie Bindle, and they submitted a written statement for the court. But also in other areas, they've just been incredibly vocal about this attempt to raise like lesbians and to sort of force lesbians to accept men into like their sexual realm and their romantic realm, which is, it's just completely rapey and unacceptable. Now, the seventh point that I wanted to talk about was the argument that's made around what is going to happen following the UK Supreme Court ruling that single spaces have to be defined on the basis of biological sex. And what the trans movement has been saying, and like things online and articles that have been published, is that this is going to result in women who don't conform being like harassed in bathrooms. So they're going to be asked to prove that they're women. They're going to like potentially be strip searched, or they're going to check to see what's in their trousers. And essentially, like, this is going to hurt them as much as it's going to hurt trans women. And also within this, they've also spoken about how it isn't just like gender non-conforming women, like butch lesbians, for example, or androgynous women, but also that it's like non-white women or women of color. So women who've got different body types or who don't present according to like a European feminine standard, quote unquote, whatever that means, that they too will be harassed in bathrooms. Now, at this point, I won't even linger too much on it because it's quite obvious. But the thing to say, and I say this with the utmost kindness, is that clearly we are able to tell who trans women are, you know, like for the most part, like 99% of the time, you can tell if it's a trans person, because once somebody has gone through a male puberty, it's very difficult to undo those changes, because puberty is such a powerful space to be in. Like your whole height changes, you develop secondary sex characteristics, like your voice changes, you've got broader shoulders, you've got bigger hands, you've got obviously on average a much higher, you're much taller than women. And also there's other, like, even outside just being able to physically recognize trans women easily for the most part, there's also lots of other social cues that tell you that the person is biologically male. And one of the things that you can notice in conversation, everyday conversation, is the nature of how men and women communicate. And men tend to be like interrupters of conversation. They tend to mansplain. They tend to overestimate their abilities. They tend to think their contributions are the most important. And they tend to not like be able to create a space for everybody to equally participate. They tend to dominate conversations in a way that's just characteristically male. So even if for some reason you can't identify a trans woman to be a trans woman, you certainly can tell in how they interact with you and other women socially. And so the idea that we can't tell the difference between a trans woman and a butch woman is completely outrageous, because the butch woman is known as a butch woman because we can tell it's a woman who just presents in an androgynous way. Otherwise, we would just confuse them with a man. But we never confuse butch women with men. We very rarely do. Because even if they dress in men's clothes and they don't wear makeup and they don't paint their nails, they still clearly have breasts. They still clearly have a woman's body. They clearly still have a woman's voice. They have a woman's height. They have women's hands. They've got women's skin. They've got women's ways of socialization. They walk like women. There's a million other things that tell you that they're women. And then as far as sort of like confusing like non-white women with men, I actually find that incredibly offensive. I have never in my life seen like a woman who isn't white, and because of that, I think she's inherently more masculine presenting. That's actually quite outrageous to say, especially because women of color tend to be more curvaceous, for example, or they tend to be more feminine in their presentation. And so again, like, It's saying things and using argumentation that sounds rhetorically like powerful, but actually when you drill down to it, like a lot of this stuff is like deeply offensive to different groups. What I do accept, though, is that trans men are a completely different story. Like, trans men who are on testosterone and hormone blockers. Like, that is, like, that, I have to say, you can, you like, it's very difficult to tell, especially when the person is, like, a little bit further in their transition, because testosterone is so powerful. So it changes, like, their muscle mass. It changes, like, how much, like, muscles they can put on. It results in, like, just them being able to grow lots of facial hair. They can end up getting, like, male pattern baldness because they've got high testosterone and it's mimicking, like, you know, what testosterone would do to men as well. And especially if they've had like a mastectomy, so they're flat chested. In everyday life, you can honestly meet lots of trans men and not know that they're trans. But of course, again, when it comes that time to like this private sphere and the romantic or sexual sphere, you are obviously going to know they're trans because they won't have a penis, they'll have a vagina. And also they might have things like periods or, you know, like, again, like they're, it's only like in public life, I agree that you definitely can't tell in a lot of cases where trans men are concerned. But as far as trans women, like, unfortunately, testosterone is a very powerful drug. And so for most of the time, we definitely can tell. And so, you know, sort of using butch women or women of color as a shield as to why we shouldn't have single sex spaces, to me, isn't particularly persuasive. And also, as I said, it's kind of offensive. Now, the eighth argument that's like somewhat connected to the previous point is this idea that if we allow this court ruling to take place, to stand, so if we don't sort of incentivize Parliament to find a way to either revise the Equalities Act of 2010 or revise the Gender Recognition Act, that this is going to result in the erosion of rights for other groups. So it's going to erode the rights of Black people and people of color or religious people. It's going to result in the erosion of the safety of gay and lesbian people. So basically what they're saying is it's in our interests to make sure that trans people like get what they are asking for, because if they don't get what they're asking for, or if there is a general like U-turn in the policies that were put in place to include them in certain contexts or to guarantee their rights in certain contexts, that it's only a matter of time until the other protected groups within the Equalities Act also face backlash. Now, I am, like, to a certain extent, like, persuaded by this argument on the surface level, because it's kind of like what we're seeing in Trump's America, where you have a lot of these MAGA voters who voted for Trump on the basis that Trump was going to get rid of people of color and he was going to bring back Jim Crow and bring back like acceptable forms of discrimination, and that they were going to be the natural like beneficiaries from that like change, that policy change, that government or governance change. And what they didn't realize was that Trump hates people of color, but Trump also hates poor people. And Trump also hates just like the average, like non-elite, non-powerful person. And so what has happened is that he has essentially like removed lots of economic protections that those groups enjoy. And he's removed a lot of subsidies, for example, that farmers were receiving. He's removed a lot of financing for like agriculture, just basically done a lot of things that affected negatively MAGA voters and their livelihoods. Even just when you think about what the deportations, like the mass deportations of people to Latin American countries has resulted in, like labor shortages. Again, it's an example of people like voting against their own interests because they're prioritizing the discrimination of another group. They're prioritizing the fact that they're getting off on the discrimination against another group, but they don't realize that it's a double-edged sword that's going to hurt them. Now, I definitely agree with this general principle in everyday life, in that what you allow for others or what you allow to happen to other people will eventually happen to you. And so that's kind of like the principle of free speech. Like the reason why we allow free speech or we hold it up as a virtue is because we recognize that although there are things and groups of people we don't like to hear speaking, or we don't like the things that they say, or the things that they say might even be like dangerous ideas to us personally as people, we still nevertheless like protect their rights to do so, because if we restrict their freedom of speech, there may come a time that we are prevented from being able to speak up our own beliefs and our own belief systems. And so it's in all of our best interest to guarantee that that is a protective virtue. In this particular case, though, however, I think it's an example of false pairing, and it's an example of how, like, people can never escape who they are. So I would describe the trans movement in general as being a primarily white organization or white movement, and I'll talk about why that is further in my last point, or in my next point. And because that is the case, it obviously means that they sure share certain values. One of those values is, like, as far as I'm concerned, if you're not an anti-racist person, you're kind of okay with how the system works. And how the system works is that it's a racist system, in that if you look around the world, it's not a coincidence that all poor countries are black and brown and all rich countries are white. And the reason why that's able to continue is because the people who benefit from the system are not incentivized to change that system because it serves them well. Now, how that relates to the trans movement is that you have a movement that is predominantly white, that emerges out of, like, Western countries, and that is, when you look at who speaks and who's represented and who's most visible, it's clearly like 95, 96, 97% white people. And because they're socialized in a racist system where they are also, like, disincentivized from seeing that it is a racist system, because seeing it kind of puts pressure on you to change it, it also means that in how they relate to people of color, like things will trickle in that are just, like, racist. So in this particular case, it's incredibly laughable that they are suggesting that the rights of people of color, black people in particular, for example, are inherently connected to the rights of trans people, because I've never known in my life to see a demonstration by trans people advocating for the rights and interests and advancements of black people. And I guarantee that these people who so quickly and so easily invoke the fact that, you know, trans rights is also a fight against imperialism, it's also a fight against colonization, it's also a fight against racism. Like, I guarantee you that in their private life, in their political life, in their public life, they have done nothing whatsoever to fight any of those issues. And they are only invoking the names of those issues because they hope that you can pair it in your mind. So if you connect that being transphobic is, like, as bad as being racist, or it's as bad as being a colonialist, or it's as bad as being an imperialist, or it's as bad as being a fascist, then it kind of grants credibility or legitimacy or gravitas to the trans movement. And it's pairing those two things together in a way where they're kind of creating a scenario in which for you to deny some of the demands that they're making kind of implies that you're also against, like, removing imperialism or overcoming colonization fully, or even, for example, when you see some of, like, the marches where it's like trans movement or trans marches and they have lots of Palestinian flags, it's kind of like an odd pairing, because, one, like, obviously Palestinians are Muslim people and the Muslim world clearly is not gay friendly and certainly is not trans friendly. And so, and also on top of that, like, those people in those marches, I guarantee, if you look and investigate, because, you know, I'm a stalker online, so I do these things, when you go back through their timeline and look at the things that they post about and talk about, they don't give an eck about Palestinians. They don't give an eck about, like, black issues or black rights or black advancements. They don't even give an eck about women's rights or women's issues or women's advancements. They're only weaponizing those issues because it serves their interests, namely in that they're creating a false pairing where they want in your mind to create the idea that the things are equivalent, so that it's the same thing or on a same level as to be trans exclusive as it is to be a racist person or a homophobic person, or to be against the liberation of the Palestinians, or to be pro imperialist or pro-colonization. So it's incredibly, like, manipulative, and it also just like isn't true. I don't even know how else to say it. It isn't true that those fates are connected, and it certainly isn't true that the people who are like instrumentalizing or weaponizing those issues care about those issues, because if that was the case, you would see that reflected in their other areas of life. Now, the second last argument that I wanted to look at was the argument that's made that trans women, in particular trans women of color, face the most extreme levels of violence from men, and that's the reason that they need to be admitted to female spaces to escape essentially the violence that they face from men. Now, I remember that I went to Black Pride last year, and one of the things that I noticed was that on the very last page of the website, they had like a fact-checking section, and the fact-checking section talked about how essentially like there is no epidemic of trans women, and in particular trans women of color in the UK being killed, and how that stat is a stat that is misappropriated from different contexts and made to apply to the UK and made to apply to trans women in the UK in a way that just doesn't mirror what's actually happening. So that was an issue what sort of like planted the kernel of thought where I started thinking about this claim. But then I, you know, for this episode, I went to look it up. And what the stats say is that in the UK, there's between 200,000 and 500,000 people who are trans. And it doesn't specify what they mean by trans, if it's like transsexual, transgender, or if it's like non-binary as well. But either way, that 200,000 to 500,000 figure corresponds with roughly 0.3 to 0.75% of the population, so under 1%. And when they did a survey, or when they did the research to find out how many people globally had been killed through like being killed because they're trans, or trans people that were murdered, they found that between 2017 and 2018, there had been 369 cases of reported murders of trans people. Now, of those 369 deaths or murders globally, about 167, so nearly half of those, took place in Brazil, and then a further 28 took place in the United States. So like nearly 60% of those take place outside the UK, like within the Americas, so in Brazil and then in North America and the United States. In terms of how many of those murders of the 369 took place in the UK, between 2008 and 2017, so over that, you know, 9-year period, there were 9 total victims. So 9 trans people were killed between 2008 and 2017. And so what that roughly means is that, obviously, that's like on average 1 a year. So the data is for a 9-year period where 9 total people were killed. So that's about 1 person per year. And by the way, this is according to the Office of National Statistics. So this is like a government figure. So I didn't just pick it out of nowhere. And so because like the average like murder of trans people was like 1 a year, and the population of trans people in the UK is between 200,000 and 500,000, it means that basically the average trans person has a chance of 1 in 200,000 to 1 in 500,000 of getting killed or getting murdered. Now contrast that with the Office of National Statistics figures for the same period of 2008 to 2007. And what they found was that the average adult in England and Wales has a 1 in 100,000 chance of being murdered in any given year. So obviously this is like a crude way of looking at the figures, but that essentially means that the average non-trans person has a higher risk of being murdered in any given year than the average trans person. And the reason why it's important to fact check these like claims, especially where like claims of like people being murdered and killed in the UK, is very important, because I actually think what they're doing is like scaring young trans people to feel like the UK is more hostile than it actually is to trans people, or that it's more unsafe than it actually is to trans people. And I don't think that trans people or people who are gay or under the LGBT umbrella need to like have fake stats or like falsified stats or manipulated stats in a way that results in them feeling unsafe, because it's already like hostile in the sense that same-sex attracted people, LGBT people, already experience, like, for example, like, social stigma. They experience social isolation. They're more likely to be, like, homeless. There's, like, all these other things. So why add an additional thing on top of that that makes people have reason to be more afraid when it isn't based on truth? It isn't based on the facts. It's literally an appropriation of the experiences of Latin American trans women in the sex industry that this is actually referring to. So what I mean by that is, like I said, there's 369 trans people that were murdered between 2017 and 2018. And then over half of those, or nearly half of those, took place in Brazil. But what the data also shows when you drill down into the 167 murders in Brazil of trans people is that the overwhelming majority of those trans people were, or trans women, were sex workers. They were sex workers. And so it isn't appropriate to cite a reference that is pertaining or referencing the murder rate for sex workers who are trans, who are in Latin America, specifically Brazil. Like, that's like me talking about the state of rights for women and using the stats for, like, sex workers in India who are living in, like, criminally organized gangs, like, where the gangs basically are the pimps and they essentially use the women as sex slaves, and there's a high rate of, like just abuse that takes place in that system, as you can imagine. That's like me using stats from that context to talk about the situation that women experience in the UK. It would just be wildly inappropriate because those are two wildly different contexts, and the figures for the United Kingdom and for the average woman's experience does not mirror the stats for the average, like, sex worker in India working in a criminal gang that's abusing her and pimping her out. So it's very important to use, like, relevant information, because when you're not using relevant information, not only are you making false claims, but you're also making claims where people have a reason to question that. So when you hear that stat of there's an epidemic of trans women being murdered, but then you never hear about any of those murders on the news, it naturally is going to trigger your curiosity and set you off investigating that information. And it's quite easy to arrive at the information that I've just quoted, that that's just not a true claim. And on top of that, like I said, it's essentially like fear mongering. Like, it's fear mongering, like, trans people, and also by extension, gay people who fall under the same LGBT umbrella. There's, like, an epidemic of people from that grouping targeted. And I just don't think that's a fair thing to do. It reminds me a little bit of Rachel Dolezal, that woman who claimed that she identified as a white woman. She was a white woman who claimed that she identified as a black woman, and she had been acting as, like, one of the local chapters for the NAACP, and she was, like, teaching, like, a course on black studies, and she, by all intents and purposes, had sort of convince the people in her lives to a certain extent that she was a black woman. And the thing that eventually caught her out was that she started posting nooses in her own, like, through her own mailbox, and reporting those nooses to the police and saying that she was the target of, like, racist attacks, that she was the target of racist targeting, essentially, and that she was afraid for her life. And actually, who questioned that information was other black people, because they essentially were like, we experience racism, but we don't experience racism in that way in this context. Like, who is going around just posting nooses into people's mailboxes? And something about the way that she was talking about this alleged experience or alleged experiences, and the way that she was talking about racism in general, essentially, like, rang the alarm in the minds of the black people in her lives. And this caused them to go investigating her life. And obviously, when they went investigating, they found out that she was not, in fact, a black woman as she had purported to be. Now, my point is merely that, as far as the arguments that are currently being used in the trans movement, I think when you use information that's just clearly feels untrue to people, and also that is then confirmed to be untrue, it kind of casts legitimacy questions in people's minds, because the next obvious question is, if things are as bad as you say, then why do you need to resort to appropriating stats that don't make sense for this context, or in some cases just making up stats? It must imply that you don't believe the status of the marginalization of your group is in fact that bad. Otherwise, you wouldn't have to resort to like using or misusing this these stats on other groups of people in different countries, in different contexts. Now, in this particular case, I actually strategically do understand or see why they resort to using those stats of the murder rates and of trans women, and using like Latin American figures for sex workers or women or trans women in the sex trade, or trans women of color in the sex trade in Latin America, is because one of the primary opposition of that the trans movement and trans women in particular is experiencing is around the protections guaranteed under the law for women as seen in single-sex spaces. And the reason why women are given those single-sex spaces protection is because they face sexual violence from men. And so it isn't persuasive enough to just say, I identify as a woman, or I feel like I'd like to be perceived as a woman, and therefore you should let me into single-sex spaces designed for women, because again, that's just not that persuasive. However, saying that there is an epidemic of violence against trans women in the UK, and on the basis of the same violence that women face, they should be allowed into female spaces, that's obviously like rhetorically and like pragmatically much more persuasive. So I think the reason why they like really lean into these stats is because they have to find a way on putting the violence that trans women experience on the same level as the violence that women experience. Otherwise, there isn't really a legitimate reason to allow trans women into single-sex spaces for women. But again, like, obviously, like I just said, like, that stat just simply isn't true. And on top of that, we know that that women face sexual violence from men in general, and the violence that they experience from men isn't just men who identify as men or who are men and identify as men, but it's also men who identify as women. Like, there's not really any difference insofar as the criminal profile or the sexual crime profile of trans women as compared to like men, like non-trans men, you know what I mean? But like from a strategic point of view, from like trying to find like the most persuasive argument, I do understand why they lean into the stats around violence, because they're trying to overcome the argument that I just said about why we need female only spaces or spaces that are based on single sex for women. Now, the final argument that I think is resulting in backlash, you know, for the trans movement, is the argument they make that there is no social cost or political cost or economic cost or just genuine or general cost to allowing like trans ideology to sort of be, I guess, normalized or accepted fully into just everyday life. And I think what the Four Women Scotland like case, you know, that they brought to the Supreme Court showed was that it does actually have real pragmatic consequences. So in this particular case, the Scottish government was proposing, as I talked about last week, to include trans women in the definition of women when it comes to positive discrimination for the purposes of ensuring gender equity on boards. So simply speaking, like I said in last week's episode, the Scottish government was trying to increase the representation of women on public body boards so that they could have essentially like a 50-50 makeup of men and women. And not just for pure number sake, but also to give them the opportunity to have those positions and also to bring their lived experiences to those roles to make like how decisions were arrived at by that body more inclusive of just generally women's experiences. And Four Women Scotland obviously highlighted the fact that the natural inclination is to give trans women opportunities over like biological women. Because again, because most people still read trans women as men, it means that they don't stop benefiting from male privilege when they transition. Like, other men still respect them more than they respect women. And on top of that, like, they often have achieved career success that's based on the fact that they are men. And so if the point of having this 50-50 board, like gender representation, being that you bring the experiences of women who haven't benefited from male privilege, who've had to face like obstacles and roadblocks because of their sex, because of discrimination based on their sex, you're not going to have that if you include trans women in the definition of like of women for the purposes of positive discrimination as represented by the Gender Representation on Public Boards Act of 2018 that the Forum in Scotland was fighting, because again, like, you're just displacing those women by giving those opportunities to trans women who read as male and who have benefited from male privilege and who are like still the beneficiaries of male of advantage and opportunities, even post-transition or post-social transition, and even sometimes post like gender reassignment. That's kind of like going back to the Rachel Dolezal example, because I think I've said this in like other episodes. I think there's a great deal of parallel between the idea of being able to be transgender and the idea of being able to be transracial. And in the Rachel Dolezal thing, what she was proposing is the idea that transracialism is a thing. And so if that had been allowed to stand and there had been positive actions that are put in place that are designed to rectify or amend or go some way to correcting the disadvantages that have accrued to the Black population as a consequence of slavery and Jim Crow and just other racial abuse over the years, if we had allowed transracialism to be like accepted in all areas, it would essentially have meant that a white woman, the Rachel Dolezal, could have benefited from white privilege her whole life and gotten the education she got because she's a white woman and didn't face these obstacles and didn't face this racism and didn't have all these different factors conspiring against her on the basis of her racial identity. We could have had a woman who literally was a beneficiary of racism, then also be the beneficiary of positive action designed to rectify the historical racism that Black people have experienced. It's kind of, not even kind of, it's exactly the same thing when it comes to allowing trans women to benefit from positive discrimination policies that are put in place to rectify the historical sex discrimination of women, or the historical discrimination of women on the basis of their biological sex. If you allow trans women to benefit, it essentially means you're allowing men who've benefited from being men from also being able to benefit from like the provisions that have been put aside for women. So it just isn't workable, it isn't fair. And to be honest, because it isn't workable and because it isn't fair and because it feels like really unreasonable, all of that has the net effect of sort of alienating a lot of people from the trans movement and really sort of underscoring the fact that gender ideology obviously has a material effect on people's lives, on everyday people's lives. In the case of the Public Boards Act that Scotland was going to pass, it would have had an impact on the women who wouldn't have been able to sit on that board because they would have been displaced by trans women. But also in recent years, you know, we've also seen a great deal of social cancellations by people like J.K. Rowling or Julie Bindle or Maya Forstater, who made statements that are now in law, like lawful, and statements that weren't ugly or mean, that were just recognizing biological reality, and statements that showed what the impact is on people's lives, in particular women, when you don't like factor in like sexual or sex or biological reality. It's the same thing with like race. The reason why being race neutral or colorblind is so like bad is because you're ignoring the fact that people do see race and they do discriminate on the basis of sex, and therefore race has a material impact on people of color in particular, because, you know, they are discriminated against in all these various ways. So it's not actually an act of kindness, and it isn't neutral to see people as colorblind, because that's just not true, that color doesn't affect people's existences. It's the same thing with this. It's sort of like people are very happy to be kind and compassionate and inclusive where it's appropriate, but when it starts being detrimental to other groups' interests and rights and protections, then obviously we have to look at the policies and adjust them in some way, not as a as an ugly retaliatory thing or to penalize trans people or to be malicious to trans people, but in a way that just recognizes the material reality of sex and how it impacts different groups like lesbians, for example, or gay men or women, and finding a solution that is workable for all people, but that doesn't subordinate the rights of women in particular to the rights of trans women, and also doesn't create a hierarchy of whose needs are recognized in the public sphere and who is expected to sort of essentially like shut up and put up. Anyway, I'm going to leave the episode there for this week. I'm releasing it a little bit late. I was supposed to post it before midnight on Monday, but unfortunately it's gone after the midnight hour because it ended up taking longer than I expected. But I hope that you enjoyed the episode and were able to get something of value. I also hope that I was able to talk about it in a relatively sensitive way, because obviously it's a very divisive issue, and it's very easy to sort of say things that offend people or that comes across in an ugly way. And in this episode, I made the decision to refer to sex and woman and man on biological terms, because it wouldn't have made sense in the context of the discussion to do otherwise. But that doesn't in general mean that it's acceptable to just go around like misgendering people or just being impolite or unkind for no reason. That's not reasonable, and it's not necessary. But at the same time, we shouldn't think that labeling people or classifying people accurately according to their biological sex where it's relevant is a slur, or is like the equivalent of a racial slur or a sexual orientation slur. It honestly isn't. It's a neutral term. And although the people who this refers to obviously feel dysphoric or uncomfortable or unhappy about that categorization because it clashes with their self-identity, that doesn't mean that classification is incorrect or inaccurate. It just means it makes them feel uncomfortable. But in some discussions, it is important to correctly speak about what we're speaking about, because otherwise the words that we're using kind of mean very little, or it's stretched or expanded to include so many things that the definition is kind of rendered like unworkable or impractical. So anyway, like I said, I'm going to wrap up this week's episode here. Thanks again for tuning in, and I'll catch you next Monday, hopefully before midnight.